David yesterday gave an overview of the 1D effects that I'm going to talk about in more generality in three dimensions. And we know that all soft condensed matter systems are affected by the static fields and their fluctuations. And if you consider interfaces, then they may have one of the following properties: different dielectric constants, they may contain electrolytes, they contain surfactants, which may cause charging, and you have lipid membranes, soap films, small droplets, nanostructures. And the effects give rise to dispersion forces, forces between charged regions. And what I want to discuss now is the classical temperature-dependent forces, but you can extend, as David mentioned, by putting in the Matsubara frequencies to the quantum effects. Matsubara frequencies contain H-bars, except the zero one, which doesn't know about H-bar. And that's the dominant effect, and that's, of course, well known. I mean, a lot of things are well known and often derived by people that are sitting here. So if I forget to mention that, it's because they're too famous to need an introduction. So this is, in some sense, a reformulation of probability of the Lipschitz theory generalized to such models. So if you go to the simplest case, you would derive Lipschitz theory that Torsten mentioned in his popular talk. You get the same formulas, of course. Okay, so here's the ionic surfactant, for example, or here's the AOT. This is the hydrophobic and hydrophilic, hydrophilic tails, hydrophobic heads. And, oh, you have lipid membranes, which, if you dissolve them in water and you get it right, you can actually form layer structures, which is either a liquid or a gel, depending on precisely the conditions, but they will be specified by bending rigidity and elasticity, etc. And what you'd like to know is the surface charging, the force acting on the membrane, for example, the renormalization of bending rigidities for a curved layer, the force between two interfaces, which David gave an introduction in 1D. And for pure dielectrics, these are examples of the, quote, thermal Casimir force due to van der Waals, although there was a discussion whether these two are the same or not, but I'm going to discuss that. The density profile of electrolyte near interfaces, the forces on and between charges near interface, we haven't really looked at that in any detail, and maybe they would have, it says likely, changes to maybe have an effect on electro properties of cells, depending on how well you can model a cell, which are much more complicated systems than the idealized systems that one discusses here, and you have to be careful not to try to, somebody said to me, try to undo a 6-inch nut with a 3-inch spanner, you have to actually have the right tool. So this is a picture that David drew, this is in French and English, that's a good EU, actually French is the heirs, kind of ambiguous, there's O here, but this is David's writing in English, so this is a good EU slide, and this is the picture that we had before, but now we've got 2D film separated by a distance L. These are the hydrophobic tails sticking out, which actually themselves are quite interesting, but they wave about. And then you have this mixture of water and sodium chloride inside, and this is fitted to a bulk. And for this talk, I should assume what David assumed, that the bulk is determining the chemical potential of the ion, the mobile ions in this system. And of course, the question of what ensemble you're discussing is actually, again, a physical question. So that is always up for grabs, and you may get the wrong answer, because we know that can go wrong. In a lot of simulations that I've done in the past, microcanonical and grand canonical and so on, you do them and they don't give the same answer because the systems truly are not big enough. And there are ways around that, but people that make assumptions that these should be the same in their simulations, for example, get bitten. So that's a physical discussion. If you look at this is the apparatus that David discussed yesterday. Here is this porous freak with a little window you can see at the end of my dot. And this is a pressure cell with a syringe here where you can change the pressure on the outside. There's a capillary tube which tells you what the pressure of the bulk electrolyte in this porous freak is, like a little sponge. And then you use X-ray scattering to measure the thickness of the film. And so the disjoining pressure, or otherwise the force you need to apply to the film to keep it stable is the object that they measure, and it's physically known that there is a collapse here to the Newton black film, as discussed yesterday, and it can even, we checked up, it can even be that you get little bubbles of collapse, little areas of collapse that twinkle on and off. So there isn't a fixed, you know, to think of this as being two flat sheets is not necessarily a good idea. And but if you think of it as one domain, as you might do in a magnet, and then push on to what the physical situation really should be, that's the sort of physical picture you would get. So the difference, the disjoining pressure is the difference between the derivatives of the free energy in the film and the bulk, and you just balance it physically with the forces. And this is a schematic. I'll show a little bit later some data that we got from a paper to deal with that. Now, I just want to reprise the derivation of the Sine-Gordon model, because I want to use this quite a lot.
Just realized you gave a whole new meaning to film noir.
Oh. And I bet it wasn't as exciting as the one you had before. So, the full quantum thermal physics can be carried out in imaginary time formalism of QED coupled to ion sources. And you sum over the Matsubara frequencies, it's finite temperature. The electrostatic potential you rotate to Euclidean time, in other words, goes to a metric which is all plus ones. And this is just what happens with Wilson lines in lattice QCD, where, of course, again, you're in a Euclidean space, and A4 is, in fact, IA0, and it's how you measure potentials. And that gives rise to the full Casimir effect, and you need to know a lot about the material properties that was mentioned in earlier talks. The classical approximation is just to keep n equals 0, which is the lowest Matsubara contribution, and of course then it's insensitive to h-bar. This is the classical physics, it's statistical mechanics, but as we know from, for example, if you look in Neenan's book, and Neenan's book, you can actually see the extensions to this. But as everybody knows, the classical contribution is the non-retardative contribution, so that means that this actually dominates in a lot of systems. Okay, so you can alternatively get this calculation out as a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, and let me just so really Pogonik and Zex, this is what David referred to yesterday in the late 80s, and this is not exclusive. Other people have done this too, and I refer to them later. So the partition function for ions at position xi with charge density, they're just point particles sitting around, and that's what you would write down for the partition function, summing over all particles, the canonical partition function. And if you introduce an auxiliary field, you can just write this like this, and these two are the same, which you demonstrate by completion of the square. Okay? So this is for n particles, so it's a canonical ensemble. However, the Hubbard-Stratonovich form does not exclude I equals j, whereas this does exclude I equals j. And so there is a self-energy in this part of the calculation, which appears, and you've got to get rid of it again. So I'll mention that later. That can be done consistently. And the coupling of the Qs to the field imply that electrostatic potential is indeed psi equals I phi. There's an I here that is the origin of that change. Or you can consider full QED and just limit it to the potential theory part of it. And this is what you would write down immediately. And here again, Q is the charge on the ith ion. And you write the partition function is this. Again, you would recast the potential as I phi. And if you go back to this grand canonical partition function, which has got n particles, I equals 1 to n here, and then do the Gibbs transformation to the grand canonical partition function, these exponentials get exponentiated. Okay? Some for the positive, some for the negative, and so you end up with the standard Sine-Gordon theory, where now you have a chemical potential and a dielectric constant, which in principle I will allow to be functions of x, but as you go through a layered system, they'll just click from one to another. Okay, so here's a typical picture that I drew. An exterior region where mu is naught, an interior region in the film where you have a Sine-Gordon theory. So the exterior region, you just have a free field. In the interior region, you have a Sine-Gordon theory. The density is mu d d mu. Mu is the fugacity, actually, not the chemical potential. And this, so mu is a fictitious, well, not, it's a bare quantity, and rho is the quantity that you fix. And this log z here, this z is not a partition function. That's a partition function. What you get is that rho is mu times the expectation value of cos phi. This guy, if you expand it far enough, actually diverges. You have to have a cutoff in it. And it's actually, those are the self-interactions. And so what you do is that you have to replace mu by rho consistently through this renormalization condition. And then all of those self-interactions will be taken out because you put a physical condition on the theory, but the Sine-Gordon theory is not renormalizable in a physics sense, and so there will still be ultraviolet divergences left, which require you, if you take account of the interactions, to put in a short length cutoff, which we know is the sort of thing where epsilon is an effective quantity, and it's where epsilon will roll off to being 1 or something like that. It's a scale on which the physics starts to see the atoms. So there are two important leg scales. One is the Debye mass. And the Debye mass, if you go back to this theory here, you can see that if you expand cos, the first term is phi squared. And if you just inspect everything carefully, the coefficient is a mass, obviously, just on dimensional grounds, and that mass is the Debye mass. So this gets you the Debye mass immediately. And you have the Bajerum length and Debye length, and the perturbation theory is in the ratio of these two. The Bajerum length is typically 1 nanometer, I think, and the Debye length in a lot of things might be 5 or something. So G is, in some systems, might be a small number. So what you have for this action in the film is an ideal term, which is this Z. I'm sorry, the Z here now stands for the renormalization constant. That converts mu to rho. I've used z because everybody uses z in field theory, and then I've got z stuck in somewhere else for the partition function. So here it is here. That gives you just a standard ideal term. That's the Debye-Hooker term, which is free field theory. I've rescaled fields so that all the nasty constants have been pushed into length scales, the Bajerum length, and so on. And so that's free field theory, and then there's an interaction term, which is this guy. There's this renormalization constant here, the -1 subtracts off various terms to do with the Debye mass, which is now couched in terms of rho, not mu, and then this term here adds it back on again, so that this whole thing adds up to what you first thought of.
Is that perpendicular to the film?
What will happen is that Z will be perpendicular to the film.
And X is along.
And X as a vector will be in the film. Okay? And then you have to think of Z here as like an imaginary time variable. So it's going to be an evolution from one slice to another. That's what's going to happen. So I'll just go quickly over the 1D case just to focus it, but yesterday what David did was to put a potential for negative charges that sat at the surfaces. So that was the hydrophobic negative charges going to the surface. They like to be there, and then the rest of the stuff inside, either their positive partner or the sodium chloride, is sitting in between here. And the integral over the zero mode of the field ensures charge neutrality. That's like a Lagrange multiplier, if you like, or it's like a delta function. And the sources that model the potential are e to the lambda rho minus, where lambda is the strength of this, it's just a parameter, and the charge density operators are e to the plus and minus I phi, which is well known from this theory. And so the partition function, this is really the notational thing I want to get at.
It looks clear, but it wasn't clear to me.
Sorry.
So there's source, there's bath, there's response. You're setting the charge there, right?
This likes, if lambda is positive, it likes to have negative charges.
Absolutely.
On the surface. And so lambda is a phenomenological parameter.
So that, when you say controls the strength, what you're saying is it's a way of turning on kind of an adsorption energy?
Yes, but the thing is here that this is this charging, the charge on the surface is dynamically adjusted by the statistical mechanics. You've not put it there with tweezers. We're looking with Rudy and Ali at the point where you actually have a physical fixed surface charge. That's a different situation.
Right. I just want to see which of those kinds of factors you're putting.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's kind of a potential for sticking that you're assigning, and then you say how much it actually sticks.
Yes, and lambda is, I say, phenomenological, and you have to think how you actually compute this in a real circumstance. But
if I were a chemist and I said my absorption energy,
that would be. I think I'm not a chemist, but I think that would be right. Yes,
you wouldn't assault me.
No, I wouldn't. That's right. So what happens? And this is really what David was sketched yesterday is that you start. You think of this as starting on this slice here. You evolve with a kernel to this slice here, and then you terminate on this slice here. And this kernel. So this is the function at the slice on the right, the function at the slice on the left, and inside is a kernel which is actually a function of L, and this kernel is simply the integral I put a Lagrangian here. You could put that, you could call it a Hamiltonian. It depends which background you come from as to what you want to call this. Okay, but this call this a Hamiltonian if you like. So this is the Schrödinger kernel for the evolution in Euclidean time Z, which is translates into L here. It's the horizontal distance, and it evolves you in this time from, well, I've evolved from L back to zero, but you could think of going from zero. It doesn't matter which way you go. And the boundary fields are phi naught and phi z, which become phi l and phi naught when you evaluate on the surface. And this is what David wrote as minus hl in the calculation yesterday, or minus hz, z. But this is the standard Feynman definition of the kernel. And this object here says take a function, take a wave function, using this parlance, take a wave function, evolve it in over time L, and you get a new wave function. This new wave function satisfies the Schrödinger equation. Sorry, didn't mean to do that. Satisfies the Schrödinger equation, and the potential here is cos phi, and there's a controlling strength of potential, which is 4 mu over E squared. So this kernel that calculates this partition function actually is this Mathieu equation, and you want, as we said before, the periodic modes. Now, it turns out that if A is small, then obviously that's this coefficient here. You can use perturbation theory. And you get this result. It's the dimerization. You go and look in Abramovitz and Steigen actually at the Mathieu functions, and they tell you what these numbers are. I mean, we didn't work these out; they're written down because it's band structure. And there's this dimerization because if you forget this, you see that it's like having a gas but with half the density. If A is large, you can't use perturbation theory. However, it's a strong it's a weak coupling expansion. Actually, you can use Feynman perturbation theory. On the you do away with this Hamiltonian interpretation, you go straight to this object here, and you expand about the Gaussian theory. You get diagrams, which is essentially Feynman. When I say Feynman perturbation theory, I guess one is in some sense doing old-fashioned perturbation theory. That's what this is, because you don't have time translation invariance, and you get this result. That's the free term. That's the second. A Debye-Huckel term, and then you can compute these. This is actually a three-loop term that's computable, and so on. So these two things actually work both ways, and this is what David showed yesterday. Well, these are the curves that we had all the discussion about, and this is what we discussed yesterday. So I don't want to press on that too much. Let's go to 3D. Then what you've got is a system, let's take a surfactant. What you have is big balls of negative charge, let's say, and little balls of positive charge. So you can't charge the surface as easily with the negative charges as the positive charges. There's diffusion layers. So you have to divide this into all the slices that have the different physical properties. And what you do is that you evolve in Euclidean time from the far left, which is somewhere over on the blackboard, up to the first interface with a kernel appropriate to that region with its own Hamiltonian. You then convolute that, maybe putting in some surface charge operators, you convolute that with a kernel for the next slice, with its Hamiltonian, and you just click through the system, slice by slice, and convolute the whole lot together. And eventually you evolve from the far left to the far right. You normalize it to a bulk system, say just free air. And this kind of encodes the transverse matrix approach, which I think Rudy and Adrian wrote something, and I couldn't find a different reference for this than ComMap, but it's a similar thing. And so what you get is a partition function written in the Schrödinger formalism, which is that you have if you take periodic boundary conditions at infinity, then phi t and phi minus t are the same. So this is an integral over the field at plus or minus infinity, an integral over the boundary fields. I'm taking a simple three slice system here. You evolve from minus infinity up to naught, t is going to infinity. You put in some operator, which is like my f's. You evolve through the film. You put another operator, and then you evolve back off to infinity. These guys at the front and the back are dominated by the ground states because t is very large, and they're harmonic oscillator states. So basically what you're doing is sandwiching between harmonic oscillator states something non-trivial for the film. And so I think what happens now is just a special function theory. This is the free particle Debye-Huckel version. And what you do is that, of course, you take Fourier components in the transverse direction, and you treat them just as a function of time. And so for each mode, this gives a Hamiltonian, a 1D Hamiltonian now. Okay? And this is what it looks like. Here is the standard time evolution, x dot squared. This is a mass, which is now k squared. This is the k of the transverse mode coming in their plane waves. And you get that the kernel evolving from phi naught to phi l is just the product of the kernels over all the from the initial to the final boundary condition on the transverse mode for each k. Now Feynman tells us how to do that, but this is easy, right? This is, if you look in Feynman's book, this is the Feynman kernel in Euclidean time. This is the Pauli-Flanvec factor, which I'll come back to shortly. Here, and then here you have a quadratic form, and phi here is a 2 vector which contains the initial and the final boundary field. So for each one, for each e, remember e is root k squared plus 1, you get this quadratic form, and you get this exponential of that, and you have this Pauli-Flanvec factor, and then all you have to do is to get the free energy is to write omega is minus kb log psi 0, and that's minus a half kbt, and then it's just the integral over k, that's what you're summing over, 2 pi to the d minus 1, because it's just the transverse directions, log det m, where m is the matrix in the quadratic form in general. Okay, and so this gives you the total free energy of that system. The point is that if you now have interactions, if you go back, I didn't put any phi to the false in and so on here. If you have interactions, you can treat them in perturbation theory. How do you treat them in perturbation theory? Well, they get plugged into, they get inserted at a certain point in Z, but then integrated over all Z. That means that you get expectation values of, say, phi squared, phi to the fourth, and so on, and you get old-fashioned perturbation theory, the one we know and love, that Feynman then told us how to add up to make much nicer Feynman perturbation theory. That works if you've got translation invariance in the z-direction. If you haven't got translation invariance in the z-direction, and people doing the Schrödinger functional in lattice field theory, Lucia and people, they have to separate out time as a complex in Euclidean space, and then you have to do old-fashioned perturbation theory. But and what is the propagator? The propagator is just the inverse. The propagator is just, actually I put M of V here, the inverse propagator is M of V. It's just the standard rules. So the self-energy of the field phi squared inside a layer So I can take phi squared, I can compute its expectation value using this perturbative approach, and if I subtract off the value in the bulk, what I find is L-dependent terms in N giving me a leftover contribution, and this gives me the contribution of the image charges. Okay, to the calculation. And of course,
I'm trying to get the image of the image here. So it's an image of the distribution. The discreteness is not the thing you're getting.
No. What I'm saying is that if you were to, because you've got interfaces, this quadratic form M depends on L. Because it depends on L, when you do the perturbation theory is just done with the appropriate element of the inverse matrix as the propagator. That's how you know you do it. And then you integrate over all K. That's an L-dependent object. If you now subtract off the L equals infinity contribution, or in a simple case, or the bulk contribution, you have a finite piece left. Right. And that tells you the effect of all the image charging for this object. And of course, if you're looking for the density, which is really, this is an phi squared is a term in the expansion of the density, e to the I cos phi, then actually this is the expectation value of the density. So there's a phi to the fourth term, there's two loop terms, and there's lots of stuff.
So you'll be building it from the phi back.
Yeah, that's correct. So you can get the profile for the density, you can get the dynamic charging at the surfaces, you can get the Casimir forces for the surface, between the surfaces. The contact value theorem is obeyed by this system. We've even showed that this week. Now, I just want to give you an example. This is the effect on surface tension due to the electrolyte, and this sort of explains a little bit about what I want to do. If you look at an electrolyte, you have a Stern layer, which is really an exclusion of particles of electrolyte. There's electrolyte of the solute. There's the electrolyte here, and then there's an exterior, and the surface tension is just the free energy of this surface take off the free energies you would have got if you didn't have the surface. And the effect is due to, well, you can say it's due to image charges, you have to calculate it. The free energy looks like this. This is S0, is this Debye-Huckel term. This delta S is this correction, which has the Z, cos 2, cos phi minus 1, etc., etc. in it. And in the first order cumulative expansion, you just pull this out as an expectation value. So this is the free part, and this is the expectation value. Now, what is Z? What is this delta S? It's just the cos phi minus 1, which is a phi squared term. So actually, what you need to compute is the expectation value of phi squared, which I mentioned before. And you have to go through a little bit of a rigmarole to make sure that you're getting the subtractions right. But this is the result that you get, where G is given by the expectation value of phi squared in the Debye-Huckel theory, and the renormalized or regulated G is that at Z take away the value at infinity. And so, in principle, you evolve from here to here with the free field theory, you evolve through the Stern layer, which you would just put a different dielectric constant in, you would then evolve to, you then plug in a phi squared at distance Z from the surface. So you evolve from here to here. You put the phi squared there, and then you evolve out to the right. So this is just like in Sergeant, this is how you would do all sorts of Euclidean field theory expectation values. So actually, when you do that, and you integrate over all the boundary fields, it actually takes the form of a big quadratic form. I mean, all of this is just a big quadratic form when you put all this together. And the thing you want is the 3-3 component of the inverse, because it's at point number 3 in my picture, right? There's a boundary field, the boundary field 1, boundary field 2, 3, and so on. And this is phi 3 squared, so I want the 3-3 component. So D looks like this. These are the contributions. H is the thickness of the Stern layer. And you get all this junk. You pick off the D3-3 component. And you find, for H equals 0, it's much worse for H non-zero, you find this term here. A lot of work's been done on this, right? Levin has written a number of papers where he uses Gibbs' isotherm and so on. But we discovered that this is the simple image charging term, right? It's like a Yukawa term, it's screened by the Debye length, and it's recurled by its image. Okay, but there's all this other stuff that comes in when you do this calculation this way, that you don't get it just by thinking of a physics situation. You've got to really do it. And I just show you the answer.
The calculation is delta equals 1.
Yeah, yeah, well, I'm just going to say that. Here. The Onsager-Samras calculation is this result without all these extra terms and at delta equals 1, so it's the log g term. This gets, the delta is the difference between the dielectric constants divided by their sum. And then there's this extra correction to the Onsager-Samras result. First of all, there's a multiplicative delta, and then there's all these log terms, and in fact, there's also order g squared log g terms that we didn't calculate. And the interesting thing is, if you send delta to 0, you don't get 0, but you get this effect here. So actually, just putting an interface, putting the particles on one side, stopping them from crossing an interface, gives you a term in the surface tension. Okay? The effect isn't huge, it's the order of a few percent. Levin, there's a lot of, I can't go into this, but there's a lot of work done by Levin, Florence Morris, and maybe other people know work. I apologize if it's not here. Okay.
Let's see if we can just take that in, because it's a little short territory anyway. It looks like a good result. So the Onsager-Samras result was for what happens to a surface tension.
It's the same problem.
Adding the salt. And their idea was that it sort of goes up and down because you have a salt deprivation at the surface.
Yep.
And the concentration gets high enough so the salt sort of pushes itself in and the bilength gets short enough. And Levin gave a magnificent talk, and I think it was here last workshop, where he took new data and his new theory, and he got a linear dependence on the salt concentration.
Well, there is
concentrations.
Yeah.
And it's just such a beautiful result. I was just trying to
see
why it's.
Now let me.
That's the result.
That's the result. This is here. We have h equals zero. What I haven't done is to tell you when you have h equals zero, you have a depletion, and so you have just the pure gas law times the volume times the thickness of the depletion layer. There just aren't particles there to create the pressure of the pure gas, and that actually is. To be honest, the dominating term, if you have a Stern layer.
The assumption of H? Or
the assumption that H is non-zero gives you an additive linear term here, proportional to H, which actually masks a lot of these results.
So if you
that's what he, that was his idea, and that's in these papers down here.
So if I could just say it back to you in a simple way, then maybe, if I pick an H and say there are no ions allowed in here, and as I increase concentration, obviously the Gibbs deficit in that H coming up linearly.
And that dominates.
Is that basically
That's it. Yes, that's it. But this is the subsequent correction on top of that. I mean, I'd have liked this to have been so dominant everybody was it. But I mean, it's typical that you calculate something and it's... But this is... And we were after the Onsager result, which is this one. But what you say is... I don't disagree. Well, I just got a list of things. The appearance... I just want to talk... quickly about 3D symmetric soap films, because I've done parallel plates here. What I want to talk about is either concentric spheres or tubes. And so you can look in these really good books. You can, Adrian's book, Nina Miran and Gerstein, and at least is not exhaustive, okay? And the triple layer was done by Nina and Adrian and Donners and so on a long time ago. So, let me just, I would like to skip this. We did this, let me talk about 3D symmetric soap films, but not now parallel ones, but ones of the cylinders in this case. The self-energy of the charges is encoded in this renormalization factor, and I will expect in all my calculations to get some UV cutoff eventually. So bearing that in mind, we look at two concentric cylinders. So you can think of this, there's a picture I'll show in a minute. Think of this as a lipid bilayer tube, okay, of a certain radius. It's being fixed at that radius for some reason. And what you do is, I'm going to think of the radius as being time, quotes, and the transverse components as being z into the board and theta around. Okay, so sigma is going to be my time variable, but if you bear this in mind, sigma is just r, and time is going to be log r. So I can write down the partition function in the Schrödinger formalism, but now my volume measure has a j of sigma, and for the cylinder it's just r dr dx, where x is the in the film, just think of a circle. And t is defined, this is general, but t is defined by this integral. So for example, t will be log sigma, log r. So at the center, for r equals 0, t is minus infinity, and for r equals plus infinity, t is infinity, right? So it's just, that's just how you get it. And for a given layer, I'm now going to work out from the middle. I go to the first cylindrical layer with a kernel, then to the next cylindrical layer with a kernel, and I just work my way out, putting in operators where I like. They're the bounding surfaces, and the partition function is just a convolution of all of these over the boundary field. So you evolve from the ith layer to the I plus 1th layer, and of course this I plus 1 occurs in the next kernel down the line because it's the starting field for the next one, and then you just integrate over all these joins. If this is a quadratic form, the whole thing is a quadratic form in the boundary fields. And you can write down a big quadratic form matrix for that, and then you can calculate with that. You can insert appropriate operators either on the surfaces or inside. So you would insert at the surfaces, and this should be sigma 2 here, but this is putting a fixed charge on the surface. Rho, I put it there, it couples to the field phi on the surface, and I stick it in here, and it just goes, and this should be 1 and 2 here. So, and I can compute density-density correlators, okay, because I could put a density operator at some point in time where I want it, and at another point in time, I can calculate this correlation function. So you, and actually, there are ways of resumming these, there are lots of bubble sums you can do, and I think Fisher, in a density-density correlator for the analytic solution, said there was a new length in the problem. By looking at density-density correlation function, how it decayed, you can get his length by doing this calculation and doing a bubble resummation. So here is the Debye-Huckel theory again. Here is my partition function, but this is now the Debye-Huckel partition function. And I get the free energy in the way that I expressed before. It's just the log of that. So there's some messy slides here, which I think I'm going to skip over a bit. This, if you look at the theory, this is what is the classical field satisfying the constraints that the boundary fields are given on each slice. So I fix them that it's phi 1 on slice 1 and phi 2 on slice 2. I need to find the classical solution. And if you assume that this is separable, you can then separate it out into a one-dimensional derivative over the time variable, and then over the rest of it separates out into this Dahlenbergian here. And you just take the eigenmodes of this Dahlenbergian. It's just like doing what I did before, taking the wave modes in a flat sheet, but now I'm taking cylindrical modes, and they have eigenvalues lambda, and you can express the classical field, the solution to the field equation, on these modes with coefficients that are just t-dependent. Okay, and these t's satisfy this equation where these are the eigenvalues, this is the measure, and away you go. So you just get this whole set of things. And you take two solutions, one of them is finite as t goes to minus infinity, one to t equals plus infinity, and then the general solution is a linear combination, labelled by s, which is the quantum numbers, okay, the excitation numbers, and labelled by, oh that's it, there's just two of them. The boundary fields are also expressed as a linear combination of the surface modes. So if you consider a layer bounded by the two surfaces S1 and S2, the relationship between the numbers that determine the solution, here, the A's, and the C's that are given from the boundary specification is just a matrix, is just a linear relation, and the linear relation is just this. Okay? We just go back and plug it in. Obviously, these guys have to determine the solution on the surfaces, and the solution was given by that linear combination, so that's straightforward. Now the free classical action is this. And this derives the Feynman path integral formula, because here the field equation came from differentiating with respect to phi, but before you did that, you did an integration by parts on to get this derivative operator, all the derivative operators acting on the same field. This became minus del squared. When you integrate by parts, you get a surface term. And the surface term is this. It's evaluated between the two time limits, and that, if you put in for Debye-Huckel theory, that's just a quadratic form in the C's, which are the guys that determine the boundary field. Remember, the C's determine the boundary field. And this then is independent of anything except the boundary fields, because it's just evaluated top and bottom. And that's the quadratic form that appears in the Feynman expression for the path integral. That's how you do it, okay? And if you actually calculate this, put all this stuff in, you can find d is f to the minus 1 g, and g is just this combination of derivatives of f's and the measure and so on. So basically there's a rote method here of figuring out what the kernel in this cylindrical system, for example, is. To go from one place to the other, it is a quadratic form. It's a quadratic form with this matrix D. These C's are the guys that determine the boundary fields for the given mode labeled by S. And then you just take the product of all those modes. So again, the partition function is just a product of all these.
At this stage, it's not clear what has to be dependent or independent. This is just internal relations.
These are internal relations because when you go from one slice to the next, you have to assume the same boundary field and then integrate over it.
But coming out to the sides and deciding about
That's
not here yet.
That's in whether you, if you have a chemical potential. I mean, I'll discuss that a little bit in the case of the tube, because I mean that's really the issue that matters.
Right.
And you know, you can't always solve that unless you study a particular situation. So this is in some sense the easy bit. It's the math bit behind it. And you know, the critique of that will be precisely what you're saying. So what you have to determine, however, I've got this quadratic form up here, but you have to determine what is this normalization, and it's the Pauli-Flambeck factor, which is actually the second derivative of the action with respect to the initial field and the final field. So basically, it's the off-diagonal element of this D matrix, D12. If you take this and differentiate with respect to Φ1 and Φ2, you pick off the 1-2 component of this. Φ1 is on the left surface, Φ2 is on the right surface. Okay. So this is the standard. This is we couldn't find this anywhere. We looked at Pauli-Flambeck's original paper, and they give this formula, so we knew this was right. But this doesn't hang around. I don't know. Does it? Seen it in books?
Kleiner.
Well, I'm sure Kleiner's done it. Yeah, that's almost certainly right. I respect Kleiner. So actually, the bottom line is that this is D. It's this kind of Wronskian-like object here times the measure, and then H is this anti-symmetric product of the Fs. Okay, now if you look in a muscle cell, this is a physical thing here. If you look in a muscle cell, you see these T-tubules. Each of these little guys is a tube of a typical range between 50 and 100 nanometers. And think of the cell surface as being circular, and these tubes, their invagination inside the cell, they go all the way out to the lipid membrane at the surface, and they connect to it. And they have all these junctions, and of course the cell has to expand and contract, and this network expands and contracts. But these lipid tubes are, however, stable at 50 to 100 nanometers. Now, this is not an obvious conformation. I mean, it's not an obvious way for these things. So the question was, why do these lipid tubes remain stable, although they're happy to expand? Now, actually, my physiology friends who study this don't really know, although they have models based on osmotic pressure. But how this can expand, for example, is even itself not an obvious thing. They're connected to the outside, so they suck in membrane from the surface of the cell. But you don't know that at each node there isn't a little crumpled up sort of store of lipids. And as you pull, they become part of the membrane and they go back in again. Okay, and it's not obvious. what is happening here at all. And if you want to model cells, which people are beginning to do, to try and get a proper dynamical model of the cell, all the chemical electrical properties, so they can build muscle sheets, that's what they're after. They want to know the best they can about how things behave. Okay, so why are they stable? Well, the free length of a tube of length and radius R due to bending is this. KBT is for units, kappa sub B is the bending coefficient, L is the length of the tube, and R is the radius, and kappa sub B is anywhere between, I guess, well, 2 if it's really, really floppy, but 30 or more, okay? So the idea was, could there be a Casimir attraction in the right ensemble that would renormalize kappa B so that there was a stability point? Now the answer is, we did the calculation, in our calculation, it's the forces are too weak to do that, okay? But I just want to, I put 1 to 30 because our number's 1, okay, so.
Floppy.
Yeah, pretty floppy. But there are some reasons to do that. Well, you go through this calculation, okay, just like I said. These are the modes, this is the field equation, this is the transverse mode equation, these are the modes, these are the eigenvalues, n along the n, which is the angular mode, and p along the tube. This is the equation for the t's, and you get these Bessel functions, and you calculate log det, and you toddle on. By the way, the Schrödinger equation for this system is this guy, which is an interesting Schrödinger equation, and it's satisfied by these wave functions. I mean, if you were asked to solve that equation, you wouldn't necessarily come up with that. But, I mean, the other way is easy, because you take what you get and then say, it's interesting. Okay, so the T-tube has a radius and a wall thickness, delta. So you go from 0 to R minus delta over 2, plus delta over 2, and then on. So you have this triple, because it's a triple system, you have a normalization here to a flat sheet. So we're saying we're pulling this tube out of a flat sheet. Now, you could disagree with this, okay? But let's say this is true. So you can do all these calculations, and you get this answer. You get two functions G, which just depend on the individual cylinders. You get a function H, which is the interaction between the cylinders, and then a bulk subtraction. And here, you do need a short distance cutoff. And the answer for G, the first variable, lambda is the cutoff. Think of it as being 2 pi over A. So this becomes X on the next slide. So you get this function G here. It's like a self-energy for each surface, which you're not interested in, perhaps. And then you get H, which is this object. And so you get this log, it's a bit like the Samaras result, you get this log here. R is the diameter of the tube. And this is the renormalization of the bending rigidity. Okay. Now I can show you what the numbers are, and the coefficient of 1 over R are these numbers. So you can see you get minus 0.3-ish. Okay, we actually, when you say simulation, we actually computed this by different methods because these are only approximate equations. Maybe the non-zero Matsubara modes will multiply this by 2 max. Okay, but you can see this is correcting the bending moment by less than 1. Whereas you want it to be corrected by 30. Also, it's a 1 over R. Really, what you'd like is a 1 over R squared or something, so there was a minimum. It's a bit like white dwarfs and things. You quite like the thing to stabilize somewhere. Klein has done this calculation. He found this bending moment to be renormalized in a positive direction. Now, either the ensemble is different, or he's actually not got the right limit as delta, the thickness, goes to 0, because we think the effect should vanish there as the thickness goes to 0. Okay. So that's an example of the layer system.
I just want to show what's in here. And what's so there's the bending, that's good.
Yeah.
And then there's the Casimir or Vandal also, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
The fact of ions coming in and out of this and any electrical, any stresses from that.
Yeah, we didn't compute that. This is purely, there's no charging here. I mean, that's the problem with lipids. These friends of mine will say, well, there's a lot of charging processes going on here. You have osmotic pressures. coming from inside and outside, and you have to explain. So I mean, this is a test calculation, really.
I'm just curious, when you're talking with your friends and you say you didn't do it, they're talking about concentrations of ions.
They are, yeah. And ion pumps, yeah.
Where are they on this?
They're not there.
On the scale, though, where would they be if you put in...
I can't answer that yet, because I haven't talked to them enough.
I mean, from the physiology point of view, this is a calcium delivery system.
Yes, indeed so.
The discovery of these things made us realize why muscles can move as fast as they
can,
carries calcium through the muscle.
Well, that's the object, when we talked about this the other day, and that's the object of this interaction with the physiologists, is to try and understand all the effects that can come into this calcium delivery system.
Right. I'm just trying to get a teeny intuition. If you put an ion in here, an ion concentration in here, and there was a little bit of outward stress from that, where would that be on this scale? I'm going to guess it'll give you a much better bending modulus, actually.
I have to pass on that. I don't know.
It might be a nice thing to put in.
Well, I will ask your advice on that. That would be a good thing. If this is just a brief sketch. If you go to Helfrich's theory, which talks about the free energy of surface fluctuations, then we know that this is not really a Hamiltonian system in the sense that there's a fourth derivative here. This is H double dash squared rather than H dash squared. So can you do the same sort of calculation? You can still derive a Schrodinger kernel for this. I mean, you find in the back of his book says statistical mechanics is much more general than just the Hamiltonian mechanics that he looked at. So we looked at the type of minority lipid here, where we say there are chemical potentials. This is a minority lipid in a bulk. So this is somehow, with some reservoir here, it's meant to be like the previous system. You can discuss that afterwards. But now, if you want to look at, say, the line tension here, the renormalization of the line tension from normal modes of vibration, then what you've got to do now is to give boundary fields which are not only H, but the first derivative of H. They come together, these two guys, the left and the right, come together in a four-component vector rather than the two-component vector. And the generalized kernel now is this, where E is a 4x4 matrix, and we can show that the normalization, the generalized Pauli-Fang factor, is actually the determinant of the off-diagonal block. And if you do that, you can get a fluctuation-induced line tension here, which is this formula here, where delta is the difference between the kappas, which are the elasticity coefficients. We took mu over kappa to be the same in both cases, because otherwise it gets to be so totally intractable, big maple shoots. And the Casimir force between the interfaces in this ensemble is attractive and takes the following form. So kappa of delta is C of delta is the number concern, and it's not symmetric in delta. It's not symmetric in the... It was symmetric before, but it's not symmetric in the... I'm basically done. You can do perturbator. I discussed about that. I've been reading this paper, which does this great calculation of two corrugated plates with T and TM modes and so on. I mean, so it motivates to think, what happens if you take a small fluctuation in the boundary and you integrate out phi, leaving an effective field theory for H? So, only just started doing this, these guys have a proper, for their calculation, have a full result which is then perturbatively expanded. I'm looking at perturbation theory from the beginning, okay? But if you take a small height field, you can write the kernel with a metric, and this is also mentioned in the paper. You can write it with a metric so that it gives the same answer whatever coordinates you use. If you then say, for a trivial metric, the surface is all wiggly, just for a single surface, say you think in two dimensions, you can take a shear transformation which makes it flat. Okay, this again sounds very similar to what you do. So basically, you do the calculation of a wiggly surface with a trivial metric, or you do the calculation with this metric that flattens the surface, Okay, but the metric is now a function of H. You now expand in H, integrate out the field, and this must be the answer you first thought of, and you can do that in the perturbation theory. There are actually operator ordering issues, but you can resolve those, and it's not totally trivial, at least I haven't done very much of this. But one term, for example, renormalizes the elasticity, where delta is the standard difference that I defined on the previous slide. On the slide before, it's just the difference between the dielectric constants divided by the sum. And you get this sort of renormalization. But then there are other graphs which give you non-local terms, which you then have to expand out. And so this is something Dave and I are going to look at later on in the week to do, because it would be nice to see that. If you want to get, this is, I've finished now, but if you take the quantum partition function, but you take all of the Matsubara modes, so you put in the omega n's, you get an extra term here, which is omega n squared. You now take t to infinity, and you just get this summation here. So now you've got an integral not only over the transverse modes, but over the Matsubara frequencies. Epsilon has been put to 1. The log of k naught to naught, I put the boundary potentials to 0 because it's a conductor. And so the only thing that's left in here is the Pauli-Flambeck term, which is the normalization. That's a shine. If you subtract off the number for large L with rho equal to this, you get this integral to do, and you end up with standard Casimir term. Okay. So that just shows at least it makes contact with something. I finished.
I have a question about your remark about Kleinhorn's work. Are you saying he gets a positive delta times kappa when delta goes to zero?
When little delta goes to zero, that's right, it doesn't vanish there. Now, of course, we say as will vanish, and I think David looked at this more than me, but...
There's a very easy argument to show, because what you can look at is generically, if you conserve the surface area in your problem. If you look at the pairwise approximation, you can compute, we're using very simple mathematics, in the pairwise approximation, what should happen. And it's clear because the pairwise, you've got attractive forces between your lipids, okay, so it's attractive, and so basically that should try and, that should give you an attraction. Yeah? And actually when you look at our result, if you just use the pairwise approximation, you do the calculation, yeah. You expand our result, then you find the correct pairwise approximation. So, you know, if you think about, if you've got a cylinder and you've got interactions between the surface of your cylinder that are attracting, so every particle is attracting each other, then basically it's clear that the cylinder wants to, because yes. You have attraction. In fact, what you can show is if you have arbitrary pairwise interactions, I mean, Roland Netz looked at this.
Yeah.
If you look at arbitrary pairwise interactions, if you've got to be careful about conserving the overall number of particles in the system, the overall area. If you have an attractive potential between the molecules making up your surface, then it actually reduces the bending rigidity. So that would favour, that'd be an attractive interaction in a cylinder. But the strange thing is actually, it actually increases the Gaussian rigidity. So it favorises the...
Well, there's a constraint that twice one plus the other is equal to zero. Oh, it's equal to some expression, but the expression is exponentially small.
Yeah.
So if one of them is positive, the other one's got to be negative. It's a weird thing.
So it comes to do with the conservation of the overall area. So if you were to charge, say, if you had a charge on a cylinder, then that would be a repulsive interaction. And so the cylinder would tend to swell open. But if you had a flat plate, actually, the charge on the plate or any sort of repulsive interaction would actually give it... So with respect to the flat membrane state, it would actually favour bending. So there are two bending rigidities. There's the one that's the topological one, which is kg, and this is kb. And so clearly, you know, it's the bend... The attract, So, if you think in terms of rigidity and fluctuations, it's not quite clear, but if you think of the bending rigidity in the geometry of a cylinder, where it's very easy to understand, it seems completely natural that if you have interactive interactions with the cylinder.
I think what David's, to shortcut it, what David's saying is that you can, we have done the calculation in this road the next way, which is where you take potentials, and the short range potentials actually, in this screen or something, and it confirms these calculations. So you kind of feel that there's something about the climate thing that is not. Well, he may not, actually like his work a lot, because he's worked in a lot of things, so he's a fairly careful guy. So there may be something else about it.
You looked at the case of concentric cylinders.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that the system could be unstable relative to off-centricity.
Well, except these are lipid membranes, so they are. I mean, you might say that it's more. Are they unstable with respect to sort of fluctuations that might make them go elliptical or something? But the thing is that the cylinders are the inside and the outside surface of a lipid. So they actually are a fixed thickness. It's got dielectric constant, what, 4 or something, 2 to 4. And the outside is water, and they're really kind of solid. I mean, I don't know what would happen if you allowed stuff to squirt in and out. But they are, it's a mechanical thing, really.